I think we can start. I apologize for the delay in getting out the reminder. And I guess I really have to apologize to people who aren't here. People that are here made and on. But anyways, okay. Vakasha, right, we can get
Thank
started.
you.
Okay,
And
thank
I'll try and finish the main part of the class on time and then give extra time for questions and discussion after. So I'm going to usually I try to intersperse discussion in the class. This time I'm going to try and keep it more to the end to respect your time since we're starting a little bit late. So last week we talked about how in storytelling, repetitions serve a very important role of emphasizing things, either by repeating a certain element over and over again until we just don't have a choice but to notice this element, or to the contrary, by creating a certain baseline of the normal of things that repeat themselves that will then allow us to notice when things start to diverge or when variations or trends appear. But sometimes repetitions draw our attention to things not by existing, but rather when they stop. And this is what happens in the section of Shoftim that we're going to discuss today. Because the book of Judges, already in its beginning, establishes and foreshadows and tells us directly about the pattern it's about to follow, the pattern of forgetting God, sinning, being oppressed by other people, calling on to God, being saved by a savior, forgetting again, and so on and so on and so on in a never-ending, depressing cycle of devastation. Salvation, devastation. And then we see it. We see it happen over and over again. And we discussed some of those recurrences last time. We're not going to repeat it right now. But then, after working so hard to establish this pattern, to get us to expect it, to get us to be with the program, the book suddenly just stops. It just drops this pattern altogether. This shift starts with the story of Shimshon. The beginning of the story of Shimshon, Samson, appears exactly like the other beginnings. I mean, not exactly, but it appears that once again there's a story of subjugation, this time to the Philistines, these people of the sea that came from the islands and settled in the seaboard of Israel and consolidated power to the point that they could dictate things also to the people of Israel who live mostly in the hills and the mountain range. And we're told that a savior is chosen, and he's chosen from the womb. God appears to, an angel of God appears to his parents and tells them that he's about to come. But then instead of following the patented familiar pattern of rising, collecting, gathering the people, leading them in victory, and then leading them as a judge for 20, 40, 60 years, however many each judge has a different tenure, and then dying, thus ending this particular cycle. Samson goes on to have all these weird, random adventures. He marries first one Philistine woman, then the Delilah, the infamous Delilah, who eventually gives him to the Philistine generals. He plays all kinds of pranks or seeming pranks upon them. It's just not so clear what he's trying to achieve. Now, classic interpreters, classic commentators on the story try and offer, they don't try, they do. They offer different interpretations of why and how Samson acts the way he acts. That's not real. We're not going to go into the story today. You can just learn the book of Shoftim for the rest of your life if you go into every story. The point I want to make, the point that I want to take from it is that already in Samson's story, even though he is foreshadowed as a normal savior, Allah, all the saviors before him, the pattern of how a judge behaves and what he does is broken. But then after Shimshon's death, and he dies in captivity, killing many of his captors with him, but still he dies in defeat, not in success, the story pattern collapses altogether. We no longer hear about other nations coming and subjugating, or the people sinning, or the people being oppressed, or a judge rising. Instead, we have a series of seemingly disconnected stories. Each of them seemingly follows a different pattern, even though I'm foreshadowing here, I'm hinting here that we will find patterns within them. But they absolutely do not follow the patented pattern of Shoftim. The collapse means that we have to sit up and pay attention because something is different. Something about the story as we saw it until now is gone. And we need to understand why and what it signifies. And the truth is that this shift in storytelling technique or in methodology or in the form of the story is very appropriate, because even as we watch the collapse of the narrative form, the collapse of the pattern of the repetition, we're also watching stories that convey in one way or another the collapse of the Israelite society. As let's open the source sheet for a second. I'm going to share it here with you. It's in the first page in the first box. As Gunn and Fewell say in Narratives in the Hebrew Bible, I'm in the first box here, with the final shattering of the pattern that held together the components of stories in a larger story, the book comes to a fitting end. Like the plot, the very nation is shattered. What we'll do today is we'll look at these stories that shatter the pattern, and we will look and we'll see how each of them separately and all of them together reflect or evoke a sense of collapse, of social collapse, both by directly portraying it, but also by using certain symbols and images that bring to mind a sense of things falling apart. How, when they do it, they draw upon themes and threads that we encountered from the beginning of Shoftim, that's kind of weaving the story together, and how they come together to deliver the final verdict of the book of Judges. And the final verdict, spoiler alert, is that the political system of Judges can't heal itself. We already kind of knew that because God already told us in the beginning. Remember when God told them, okay, I'm never going to let you defeat all these nations around you, and you're going to have to live with this temptation and with this threat for the rest of the time. We already knew that healing is not going to be easy. But what we learn as we follow these stories we're going to read together today is that there might be healing if the political system changes. And this sets the ground for the rise of the Israelite kingship, which is the theme of our overarching course. So instead of me talking a lot, let's delve into the text and see the first story that really totally diverges from the pattern we saw until now. And it's a story that, at least on the face of it, looks like it might be optimistic, at least in the get-go. This is box two, and this is Judges 17, and I'm going to read it in the English. For those of you who want to see the Hebrew, it's right here next to it. There was a man in the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micha. In Hebrew, it's actually, what's written here is Michayahu. And I want to draw your attention to the fact that his word, the name itself includes God's name, Yahu. Like, it includes the letters of God's name. He said to his mother, we get no background about who his mother is, we don't get her name, we just start media res, like in media res. We start in the middle of things. The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you so that you uttered an imprecation, which you repeated in my hearing. We have to understand here when we talk about imprecation in Hebrew, it's the word Allah, is that she must have cursed the person who stole the money from her. I have the silver. I took it. He's coming clean. He's confessing. And the mother responds, not in anger, not in rejection. She responds with love to him, with forgiveness. Blessed of the Lord be my son, said his mother. He returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, but his mother said, I herewith consecrate the silver to the Lord, transferring it to my son to make a sculptured image and a molten image. I now return it to you. So when he gave the silver back to his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave it to a smith. He made of it a sculptured image and a molten image, which were kept in the house of Micha. Now, by the way, it's still Michayahu. His name here is still Michayahu, not Micha. Now that the man Micha, and now Hebrew also is Micha, he lost the name of God in his name, somehow it was dropped here, had a house of God, he had made an ephod and teraphim, the tools of the rituals, as they are also in the tabernacle, and he had inducted one of his sons to be his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did as he pleased. In Hebrew, it's a famous phrase, "Bayamim ahem en melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'enav yaseh." Yashar means straight. Every person did what seemed straight, what seemed like the right path, the straight path to them. On the face of it, a nice story where instead of the family collapsing because of the son's transgression, we see healing, rapprochement, the mother forgives the son, they do something positive, or at least in their mind, positive with the money. But underneath all of that, we see the cracks. We see, for example, that Micha didn't confess just out of the blue. Clearly, he's confessing because he heard his mother cursing whoever stole the money. He's referencing to that. We are left to wonder if he didn't overhear it, if he wouldn't have overheard his mother curse, if he wouldn't have been scared of the power it might hold to damage him personally, would he have come clean? We don't know, but it's a legitimate question. Then we also see the matter of his name, that for a while there, he still has God's letters, the letters of God's name in his name, and then they drop out. Why is that? This is another alarming sign, a warning sign. Then let's do some math. The mother says, okay, you give me back the money and I'm dedicating it to God. But how much of the money is she actually using for God or for her understanding of what God is? So he stole 1,100 shekels of silver. She uses 200 shekels of silver after promising the entirety of the sum. She's defrauding God. Her son stole from her. She's stealing from God. This is not exactly an innocent situation here. And of course, there's the fact that what they're doing itself is all prohibited. This goes directly against God's instructions. They're serving God, worshiping God in the very way that God asked them not to serve them. The words here, when it says that every person did what was straight in their own eyes, is a direct reference. It's an allusion to a text from Deuteronomy. Let's look ahead and see it. I'm going to read it out loud. It's in box 3. But look only to the site that the Lord your God will choose amidst all your tribes as his habitation to establish his name there. There you are to go, namely the place where you're going to build the temple in Israel. This is an instruction on what you should do once you come to Israel. You should not serve God in various places. You should have one center. And there you will bring your burnt offerings and other sacrifices, ta 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 ta. And here comes the important sentence. You shall not act at all as we now act here, every man as he pleases, which in Hebrew is ish kol hayashar be'enav, every person what is straight in their own eyes. In other words, when we're told here that in the days of Micha, every person did what was straight in their eyes, this is a hint, it's an allusion that's supposed to remind us that this whole story represents a form of worship that directly goes against what God expected from the people to do. In other words, what we're seeing is a problematic filial relationship where the son steals from his mother and maybe makes up with her, but in kind of a post-factum way. Then there's the question of the money, that it's not so clear if she promised all the money for God or not all the money for God. Maybe she meant some of the money to go to Micha. There's something, as we say, there's something stinking there. There's something not quite right. We don't know. In and of itself, it could be innocent. It just, when you add up all those different things, they start perturbing us. And then we see that not only the filial relationship between a woman and her son is fraught, but the filial relationship between God and his nation is fraught. So we're left with this somewhat disturbing feeling. But the story doesn't end here. What we hear next is two stories of immigration, of displacement. And this, by the way, we spoke about how these stories draw upon themes we already saw in Shoftim. Part of the recurring problem we see in the book of Judges is that people don't have a place. In the beginning, the sin that started the pattern of Shoftim was that they didn't fully conquer the land. People didn't fully settle where they should have been. So they don't have a place. Later, we see people moving from place to place a lot of migration that has to do with those oppressions that happen and bite into people's territories and threaten their lives. And this is exactly what we're going to see here. First, on an individual level of one person being displaced, and then on a tribal level. Let's look at it together. I am in box 4, which is on page 2, if you have the source sheet. There was a young man from Bethlehem of Yehuda, Bethlehem Yehuda, from the clan seat of Yehuda. He was a Levite and had resided there as a sojourner. As a Levite, he's not of Bethlehem. He's not of the tribe of Yehuda, and yet he lives there. But then he leaves. This man had left the town of Bethlehem of Yehuda to take up residence wherever he could find a place. On his way, he came to the house of Micha in the hill country of Ephraim. And Micha approaches him and talks to him and listens to him and makes an offer to him. I'm jumping ahead to verse 10. "Stay with me," Micha said to him, "and be a father and a priest to me. And I will pay you 10 shekels of silver a year, an allowance of clothing and your food." The Levite went. The Levite agreed to stay with the man, and the youth became like one of his own sons. Micha inducted the Levite, and the young man became his priest and remained Micha's shrine. "Now I know," Micha told himself, "that the Lord will prosper me since the Levite had become my priest." Again, on the surface, this seems like a very touching story. In a book where we saw families collapse, think about Yiftach sacrificing his daughter, for example, right? Think about Shimshon and his troubling and problematic marriages. Think about Micha's relationship with his mother herself, himself. Here we see a relation, two people, two men coming to form a family. A man of some affluence, Micha, basically adopting this young sojourner who's displaced and doesn't have a place in the world and turning him into his son. Ke'echad mibanav, as one of his sons, as it says here at the end of verse 11. It's very touching. It's very moving. And we might delude ourselves into thinking that things are on the way up, that things are going better. And now the story steps aside and tells us another story of migration and displacement. Except this time, instead of one man living in one place, having to move and make his luck elsewhere, his fortune elsewhere, what we see instead is an entire tribe. We're told that the tribe of Dan, who was supposed to settle down on the seaboard of Israel, on the southern seaboard of Israel, didn't have where to settle. Now, we happen to know that the Philistines were very prevalent there and that there was a real difficulty fighting finding purchase on the land there. And the tribe of Dan has to decide what to do. How are they going to handle the situation that they don't have land? Let's see what they do. I am in, just a second. I am here in box number 5. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of Dan was seeking a territory in which to settle. For to that day, no territory had fallen to their lot among the tribes of Israel. The Danites sent out 5 of their number from their clan seat at Zorah and Eshtaol, valiant men, to spy out the land and explore it. "Go," they told them, "and explore the land." When they had advanced into the hill country of Ephraim as far as the house of Micha, they stopped there for the night. Finally, one could say, right? Finally, in a book that started with the people losing their sense of initiative, we see people who are showing initiative, who are going out and seeking their place and trying to settle the land. Not only that, when those spies come back, they come back with a glowing report. Let's look at it. It's the next quote. I'm going to start from verse 9 here. They replied, "Let us go at once and attack them, for we found that the land was very good, and you are sitting idle. Don't delay. Go and invade the land and take possession of it, for God has delivered it into your hand. When you come, you will come to an unsuspecting people, and the land is spacious, and nothing on earth is lacking there. They departed from there, from the clan seat of the Danites, from Zerah and Eshtaol, 600 strong, girt with weapons of war. Does that remind you of anything, this whole interchange? I'm sorry?
Shalach lecha, only in reverse.
Exactly. It's the reverse of what we saw in the story of the spies in the desert. In the desert, the big tragedy of the desert, the tragedy that led to the destruction of an entire generation, that just died in the desert and never made it to the promised land, was that when they sent spies, the spies came back with disheartening reports about how there's no way we'll be able to conquer this land. And the people listened and cried and said, okay, we don't want to do it. It's too difficult. Let's stay here in this displaced reality of the desert. And here it almost looks like we're seeing a story of redemption or tikkun, like a mirror image of that disheartening story. We see spies who come back with God's name on their lips. They're saying, God will help us. We can do it. And immediately the people get up and rise and walk. And it really looks like they're about to grab their destiny in their hands. And perhaps on some cosmic level, close that open wound that remained in the Jewish psyche from the desert of that failure to act. That's what it looks like. Just like it looked like the Levite son, the Levite boy being adopted into the fold of Micha's family is a story of redemption, of building family. But what we're about to see is just how deceiving and how illusory this hope is. Because when the Danites are traveling, first of all, I have to pause here and rewind a little bit and say that when the five Danite spies were traveling looking for land, they passed through Micha's house and Micha hosted them beautifully, which again seems like a story of nice overtures. You know, in a book where we saw how one tribe doesn't help another time and time again, and how every time the tribes were oppressed, they had to fight for themselves because people didn't fight together. And how when Yiftach finally went and fought against the Ammonites, the Ephraimites wanted to fight against him, and he had to eventually fight against them and killed 42,000 of them. We just mentioned that at the end of last class very briefly. Here we see a different reality where a person from one tribe, Ephraim, is hosting the men of another tribe, Dan, and helping them along their path. But that too shall be squashed, because when the Danites travel back through Ephraim, now as a whole tribe, the spies have an idea. They go back to Micha's house. They bring with them 500 warriors with their swords upon them, standing at the gate of Micha's house. And they take all of Micha's ritual things. They take his idol. They take all the ritual, the fod and the tefillin, all the things Micha created to serve this idol. And they say, oh, we like this. We'll take it with us. Let's look at it in the text. So they turned off there and entered the home of the young Levite at Micha's house and greeted him. The 600 Danite men, geared with their weapons of war, stood at the entrance of the gate, while the five men who had gone to spy out the land went inside and took the sculptured image, the ephod, the teraphim, and the molten image. The priest was standing at the entrance of the gate. And here comes a long part where he says, wait, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And we expect him to stand up for his adoptive father, right? But that's not what happens. What they say is, but they said to him, be quiet, put your hand on your mouth. Come with us and be our father and priest. Would you rather be priest to one man's household or be priest to a tribe and clan in Israel? The priest was delighted. He took the ephod, the household gods, and the sculptured image, and he joined the people. Taking the things Micha had made and the priests he had acquired, they proceeded to Laish, a people tranquil and unsuspecting, and they put them to the sword and burnt down the town. Instead of a story of a tribe taking initiative and doing something right, instead of a story of two men coming together to form a family, what we see here is the Levite boy showing no loyalty to the man who took him in, but rather pursuing his own personal self-interest. And we see, almost in a parallel, an entire tribe pursuing their own personal interest at the cost of both Micha and those people, inhabitants of Laish, which were never supposed to be conquered according to God's plan. This was just not supposed to be where the Danites were supposed to live. But what do they care? It's an unsuspecting, weak people. They'll take what they can. And when Micha tries to stop them, when Micha stands up and say, why are you doing this to me? They tell him, hush, be careful. You wouldn't want to speak in a way that will offend these people. And they kind of point to all these people with all their swords. You wouldn't want to take that, right? You wouldn't want to make them angry. And Micha takes the hints and steps down. Not to forget, as somebody just wrote in the comments, Micha himself started his career of creating this counter tabernacle, this ritual center that's not the right ritual center, by stealing from his mother. In other words, the original sin that started this whole section in the book of Shoftim, the section of Micha's idol, haunts the rest of it and comes to bite Micha himself. Because what is created on the premise or on the foundation of theft, of people pursuing their own personal interests at the expense of others, ends up creating a world or being part of a world where other people stronger than him will steal from him as well. In fact, it's not even theft, it's robbery. Sorry, it's robbery in open daylight. They're not even trying to be stealthy about it. It's just grabbing. And of course, as Frana wrote, is anybody supposed to have or worship idols at all? The whole story is depicting a reality that's a transgression from the beginning, from the get-go. So on every layer of the story, what we see is what looks for a short, brief time as an optimistic sign of building something, an optimistic sign that we need to kind of squint to see as positive, because what it's all about is about idol worshiping from beginning to end. But let's say we can ignore that for a second, just look at it as human drama and feel hopeful. And then time and time again, it gets squashed by people following their personal interests to the exclusion of any decency or sense of rightness or sense of goodness. Now, not only is the story a very potent depiction of collapse of a society where people are, you know, man to man is wolf, where people are the rule of the strong, people just take whatever they can and want, and other people don't have the power to stop them. Not only do we see that, but the way the story is told ties it back or kind of evokes earlier moments in the book of Judges. We saw already in the book of Judges, like we said, the tribes that don't cooperate. And once again, we see how one tribe just walks through the land of another and takes what they want from it. We saw in the book of Judges, people who are unable to form unions, either as a family or as a nation. We spoke specifically about Iftach, but there's stories we didn't mention. For example, Gideon's sons. Gideon, whom we talked about a little bit last week, after his death, one of his sons, a bastard, kills all of his brothers to take power. And of course, this literal murder of brothers duplicates itself on a very wide spectrum when tribes fight against each other or don't help each other in their hour of need. What the story of Micha's idol does beautifully is that it takes all those different themes and consolidates them into one narrative that from beginning to end shows us how, when there's no king, when every person does what they think is straight, when there's no ritual center to hold the people together, the whole thing just can't hold together at all. I want to pause here for a second. We really don't have much time today because we're late, but I want to pause here for a second and see if anybody wants to comment or ask questions before we move to the next narrative unit, the narrative unit that closes the book of Judges and really brings it to a terrifying crescendo. So please either speak up or write it in the chat, and we'll just be brief and move forward. Somebody asked if we saw the word idol. Yes, we did. You can look later. I don't want to delay on that. Susanna Levin pointed out that there's another perversion here, which is that Micha takes a Levite and treats him as a Kohen. And I think that's another a deeper perversion than we think, because it's not just taking, it's not just that it's a transgression over God's will. It's also a a corruption of language. It's a corruption of the symbols. It's a corruption of how we understand who is who and who is what. All those things fall apart. There's no longer any consistency in the way things are described. Anybody else wants to ask or comment or add something? Okay, so let's move forward. I'll give more time for questions later. We left Micha, we left the Danites. We were informed, and I will just say that before we move forward, we're informed that Micha's idol stands proudly as a ritual center for the rest of the era. Look here at the last source in the whole page. The Danites set up the sculptured image for themselves, and Yonatan, son of Gershom, son of Menashe, this is the Levite boy, and his descendants served as priests to the Danite tribe until the land went into exile. They maintained the sculptured image that Micha had made throughout the time that the house of God stood at Shiloh. The sages say about it that the smoke of the offerings from Shiloh would mix with the smoke of the offerings from this center, which is a beautiful visualization of this place where there's no one center that gives meaning and structure to the rest of society. And we're left with this somewhat depressing scene. And then we start another narrative unit. And once again, just like in the story of Micha, and this is where we start seeing a new pattern emerging, what we're seeing is a scene where there's some transgression in the background, and it seems like this transgression is about to be corrected and a family is going to be healed. Just like Micha and his mother, we get the sense that there was a transgression, but now they're being healed in the beginning of the story. Another family that somehow was broken is about to be healed. Let's look at it together. It's at page 4, source 6. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a Levite residing at the other end of the hill country of Ephraim took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Once his concubine deserted him, leaving him for her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and the word in Hebrew is not just deserted, but tizneh, which implies prostitution, it implies infidelity on some level. And she stayed there at her father's house a full 4 months. Then her husband set out with an attendant and a pair of donkeys and went after her to woo her and to win her back. She admitted him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he received him warmly. Great! We're about to watch a story of healing and reunion, right? Except it's a book of Judges. So whenever you have an optimistic beginning, you know to look out for the collapse to come. And indeed, this is what happens. This is the very famous story of the concubine in Givah. I'm going to just recapture it in words briefly because we don't have time to read through the whole thing. The man and his concubine unite. They decide to set out. At first, the father keeps trying to get them to stay with him and celebrate with him. And because of that, they leave relatively late in the day. They don't leave first with first light. And they start traveling, and the slave boy or the servant tells the master, we should stop for the night. Let's stop here in Yevus, which is a not Jewish town at the time. But the man says, no, I don't want to stop at this non-Jewish area. Well, I don't know how they'll treat us. Let's go until we get to a Jewish area. And they go until they get to the land, a land that was allotted to the tribe of Benjamin, to a city named Givah, Hill. Remember that name because it'll come back in a few lessons. It'll come back in the story of Shaul, King Shaul. They get to Givah, they go to the street, and they're in the street. And they're in the street. And they're in the street. And then a man comes out, and the man tells them, oh, you're strangers here. I'm also a stranger here. I live here even though I'm not from Binyamin. Come to my house. And the Levite tells him, the Levite and his concubine, yes? The Levite tells him, well, I can bring my own food. I can pay you, I can, whatever. I can compensate you. You don't need to worry about feeding me. And the local man says, don't worry about it. Just come. Don't stay in the street. And I want to point out that there's three alarming foreshadowings in the narrative so far. First of all, the fact that they don't want to stop in the not Jewish city because who knows how they will be treated there. But then disaster actually strikes them in the Jewish city is very poignant. It tells us that we, the Israelites, became worse than those other people in the land that we feared. We became worse than the people we feared. Secondly, I want to point out that the fact that the Levite feels compelled to explain that he has food so his host doesn't have to worry about it shows that there's some reluctance. He expects there to be reluctance over sharing food. And this is a theme that Yael Ziegler, the wonderful teacher of Torah, points out is a theme that runs throughout the book of Judges. Time and time again, people refuse to share food with one another. And clearly the Levite men expect some sort of reluctance like that. And this again gives us a hint as to what kind of society we're looking at. Also the fact that the only man who takes them in is a man who's also not local, who's not of the place, tells us something. It means that he, as someone who is a stranger himself, has some compassion to them, but the people who are native, the people of Benjamin who are native, they don't see the Levite man traveling through their land as someone they should show hospitality to. And of course, the fact that the local man says, just don't stay in the street, whatever you do, don't stay in the street, is very alarming. Not to mention that all of that reminds us or echoes a story we are all familiar with from the book of Genesis. The story about the two angels coming to the city of Sodom and Lot, who was also not of the city of Sodom, right? He was Abraham's nephew, inviting them against the rules or against the expectations of the people of the city. He, who is also a sojourner in Sodom, brings them in, but the city people are not so happy about it. The people of Sodom, as we remember from Genesis, then surround Lot's house and demand that he surrender the guests to them to rape. And Lot tries to push them off with the very painful and odd statement of, let me give you my virgin daughters instead. By the way, the virgin daughters that end up raping Lot, in a sense, later in the story, in a nice, measure for measure, kind of a biblical measure for measure moment, but that's a different story for a different time. Cheers. And then the angels save Lot and his family because it turns out they're angels. They don't need Lot to save them over the sacrifice of his daughters, et cetera, et cetera. So if the story of the Levite man and his concubine in the street being hosted by this man telling them, don't stay in the street, come to my house, reminds us of Lot, it's about to remind us of the story much more strongly, because what we're watching is practically a rendition on the same theme. Let's look in the text. We leave the people in the host has the Levite man and his concubine. The people of the city surround his house and demand that he surrender the Levite man to be raped to them, behaving pretty much exactly like the people of Sodom. Once again, the old man, the host, tries to offer his daughter, to offer the concubine. The people keep demanding, and eventually the Levite man, the guest, acts. Let's look together here in the same box. But the man would not listen to him. So the man, and here we're talking about the Levite man, the man who went all the way to bring his concubine back and heal their broken relationship. He seized his concubine and pushed her out to them. They raped her and abused her all night long until morning, and they let her go when dawn broke. I want to point out that this description is very long. It describes all night long until dawn broke. The Bible is very, very sparing with words. The fact that it gives us all these details, it's asking us to pause here. It's telling us, pay attention. The passage of time, the fact that it took all night long, the fact that it was such a prolonged act of horror, not one guy doing something wrong and other people stopping him, but rather a citywide celebration of horror all night long. It's something we need to dwell in. Now, it's something that requires our attention. But it's not just the city people who are being very harsh here. Also, the man who pushes his own concubine out doesn't come out looking that great. And then look what happens in the morning. In verse 26, toward morning, the woman came back, and as it was growing light, she collapsed at the entrance of the men's house where her husband was. When her husband arose in the morning, he opened the door of the house and went out to continue his journey. And there was the woman, his concubine, lying at the entrance of the house with her hands on the threshold. Now, we might expect him at this moment to cry out in horror or to pick her up or anything that shows that he recognizes the travesty that just happened here to a woman that he had an intimate relationship with. What he says is, get up, he said to her. Let us go. In Hebrew, kumi venelecha, two words. All he offers this concubine who was raped all night for his sake, to save him. Two words, kumi venelecha, let's go. But there was no reply, so the man placed her on the donkey and set out for home. He takes this dead woman and he does the following in verse 29. When he came home, he picked up a knife and took hold of his concubine and cut her up limb by limb into 12 parts. He sent them throughout the territory of Israel. And the people respond. They unite around this cause of the dead concubine. I'm continuing here in page 5, source 7. So all the men of Israel united as one man massed against the town. In Hebrew, ke'ish echad chaverim, as one man, friends. Does that remind you of anything, this expression, ke'ish echad? Does that evoke anything to anybody? To me, it's very reminiscent of Sinai.
Ke'ish echad b'lev
echad. I'm sorry?
Ke'ish echad b'lev echad.
Exactly, ke'ish echad b'lev echad in Sinai, that they stood as one man with one heart. So here they are again, united. Now, and once again, we see the same pattern of hopefulness, false hopefulness, but hopefulness nonetheless, right? Throughout the entire book of Judges, we kept waiting for the people to work together, to unite together. And they do, and it's as glorious as Matan Torah, as the moment when they received the Torah and they stood together. But what are they united to do? They're united to go into civil war against the tribe of Benjamin. They united not in love, they're united against one of their own. To be fair, they don't just attack, they first demand from the Benjaminites to surrender, to extradite the people responsible for the rape, which is a silver lining because it means that they thought it was obvious that that will be done. They had some expectation of decency. But the Benjaminites refuse, and a civil war is declared. And the people, again, in our return to the beginning of Judges and the hopes we lost in the beginning of Judges, the people do exactly what they did at the very beginning of Judges. They asked God who should lead them. They proceeded to Bethel and inquired of God. The Israelites asked, who of us shall advance first to fight the Benjaminites? Who will rise first? This was the question that started the entire book. And the entire book started when the people came and said, God, who should rise up first for us? And God said, Yehuda. And instead of Yehuda leading all of them in war, Yehuda fought their war first and went home. But here it's not what's happening, even though the answer is the same. The Lord says, Yehuda first, and Yehuda leads all of the tribes except one in a war against Benjamin. In other words, we have this very powerful Putin image of a body, a physical body being torn, uniting the nation, except that the nation is set out to destroy the body politic, to tear one of their own limbs out. And they do. Over several days of horrific warfare, they bring the tribe of Benjamin to almost complete extinction, children, women, and men. And then they pause. And then it's as if the reality of what they did dawns on them. And they look at the very small remnant of the tribe of Benjamin, and they're horrified. Because in the beginning of the war, they made a vow. The vow was that they will never allow their daughters to marry into the Benjamites. But the Benjamites are so horrific in their mind now because of this horrific rape that was committed under their, in their territory, and because of the protection they extend to the rapist in the story, that they refuse to ever have anything to do with them again. Not only that, but in order to solidify this unity, this perverse unity, they made another oath. They swore that if anybody in the entire nation of Israel is not sending people to this war to help them subdue the Benjamites, they will treat that city or that place or that region as the enemy as well and eradicate them too. They're so determined to unite ke'ish echad belev echad, as one man with one heart, against their own brethren. And they carry it out, and they almost bring an entire tribe into extinction, and then they pause, and they're horrified. And they say, we can't allow that to happen. We can't allow an entire tribe to become extinct. This is part of us. Suddenly, they remember that. They remember that connection. They remember the flesh that ties them, the bonds that tie them, the bonds that throughout the book of Judges were neglected in the name of personal and tribal interests. Suddenly, they remember them. And they come up with two solutions to the problem of the survival of the tribe of Benjamin. Does anybody remember what the solutions are? And wants to, Zella, yes?
They seduce the young girls. They actually kidnap them and rape them, and that, or not rape them, they become their wives.
Tuba'av. Tuba'av, exactly, in the 15th of Av. But I'll get to that in a second. I'll recap that in a second, because before they go to that long-term solution, they find a short-term solution for these particular men that are now the sole survivors of the tribe of Benjamin. Does anybody remember? I'll give you a hint. It's not pretty. Remember the second vow? The vow that if anybody doesn't come to do war against Benjamin, they'll kill them? So when they're trying to figure out how to save the tribe of Benjamin, they check, and they note that the city of Yavesh Gilad, a big city in Transjordan, didn't send anyone to war. They were not part of the war effort. So they send warriors to Yavesh Gilad and kill everybody except the young girls that just hit puberty, the girls that could never have been with a man before, the virgin girls. After killing their fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters and infant babies, brothers and sisters, they take these girls and give them to the Benjamites. As we saw throughout our discussion today, people are doing something that seems like a healing gesture, but it's premised on such horrible things. Just like Micha and his mother are reconciling over idolatry, here they're promising, they're guaranteeing the survival of the tribe of Benjamin over the slaughter of an entire city. But then they say, okay, this is not enough. And then they do what Ellie and Zella mentioned. And they say, okay, we have to institute some way for the future generations of Benjaminites to be able to have wives outside of their tribes. And they make this holiday of Tu B'Av, of the 15th of Av, where the daughters of Israel dance in Shiloh in the vineyards. And the Benjamites are practically invited to come and kidnap them as wives. Because then the idea is that they didn't give them. The oath was that the men of Israel will not give their daughters as wives to Benjamin. In other words, even when they're trying to heal the way they do it is in its foundation over violence. And the fact that it's violence that's committed against women is not incidental. And it's not only something that, oh, we in the postmodern era notice. It's something that's baked into the narrative of Shoftim. Because as Yael Ziegler, again, in her brilliant work on judges, I highly recommend it's a book actually about Ruth, but she talks about judges in it a lot, points out, in the book of Judges, there's this subtle and very powerful motif that every time a woman is taken out of her house or steps out of her house in some way that isn't beneficial to her, we can count on the fact that this house is about to collapse. When the daughter of Iftach steps out, the house we know is about to be ruined. When the concubine is pushed out of the threshold, not only her own life and her family are about to be ruined, but the body politic and the national home are about to be destroyed. And we're left wondering, when those girls are taken from the vineyard by force, what is about to collapse? This is left as a hanging thing. We're not told. We're presented with it as a moment of healing. But the open question remains in our mind as readers. What does that portend? What will happen to the nation of Israel where the entire nation builds its culture, its institution, its structures of how to continue life together on acts of violence committed against women? In other words, on acts that break apart homes. And the book ends with this legacy of violence and with the famous words that already repeated themselves several times by now in these last chapters. Bayamim ahem, I'll read it in Hebrew and English. Bayamim ahem en melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'enav yaseh, the last word of the book. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did as he pleased. In other words, it's as if the book doesn't trust us to draw the right conclusion. And it's worried that maybe despite this horrific collage of social, moral, religious, physical collapse and tearing apart, we're not going to understand what we're supposed to learn from all of that. So it tells us, it makes the point for us. It tells us, in case you're wondering why we got to this point, it's because in those days there was no king and each person did what was straight in their own eyes, which, as I mentioned in the beginning, doesn't mean exactly what we think it means. It doesn't mean people just do whatever they want. It means that there was no ritual center, that people didn't have one religious center where they brought their offerings, but rather every person went wherever they went. In other words, there's no centralized government and there's no centralized ritual. Everybody is left to fend for themselves. And when people are left to fend for themselves, the book hints to us, what will guide them is survival and personal interest and their strength to take what they can, basically. Be it a woman, be it an idol, be it people's trust. Now, I don't want to leave you with this very, very depressing conclusion. And I want to point out a few very subtle foreshadowings of redemption in this narrative of collapse. But before I do that, I want to open the stage to you and ask you for comments, questions. I'll start by reading things in the chat, and then if anybody wants to speak up, by all means. Just a moment. Somebody asked, Joshua didn't give Dan land. So Dan has a history of sculptured images, which comes into play post-King Solomon. So I don't know, I can't refer right now to post-King Solomon, but Yeshua did allot land, but they totally failed at conquering it. They were unable to conquer it altogether. Eli Paso pointed out that when we talk about the Levite boy who was the priest in Micha's temple, in Micha's fake tabernacle, counter tabernacle, he's the son of the son of the son of Menashe, but the letter Nun in the name Menashe is written as a small letter.
Raised
Nun, right, not small, it's raised. It's as if it's like a little bit removed. And the commentators say that this is a hint that this is the grandson of Moshe, but out of kindness to Moshe, instead of saying that, we're adding that nun to kind of cover up his shame, which only brings home how much of a perversion this reality is, that the blood and flesh of Moshe Rabbeinu, the Moshe Rabbeinu, is part of this travesty, of this like mockery of what ritual is supposed to be. The people of Shevet Dan, Lauren Blatt asked if they were given two areas. So no, they were given one area and they went and took the area up to the north where they became more known for, where today in Israel, there's a river called Dan for their area up north, but they just took it. Somebody whose name is not written here asking a very poignant question. Are the people united for the woman's honor or the men's? I think it's pretty clear that it's the men's. I'm just going to call it here. You can argue against it, but I think it's pretty clear that they're horrified by the crime that happened, but the way the woman is treated here, both by her husband, so to speak, and by her father, and by everyone fighting this war following her death, she's not central to it. She, as a person, she's not. In fact, we know that because she is not named. She's just called the concubine. She has no name. She joins she becomes the last in the long list of people, which towards the end of Judges lose their names. If in the beginning of Judges, we are told that somebody is somebody's son, is somebody's son, is somebody's son, and we still see it moving into Judges, slowly people start losing their names. Micha is losing half of his name, right? He's Michayahu in the beginning, and then it becomes Micha. His mother is always nameless. The Levite boy is, we have his name, but it's only given later in the narrative. Later, all the people in the drama of the concubine don't have names at all. Somebody pointed out that women stepping out of the house goes back to Dinah, the famous case of Dinah, who went out and was kidnapped and raped. I would argue that there's still differences in the story, but yes, this is definitely something in the background. And AY, I think, shared the Amazon link to the book by Dr. Ziegler, and I highly recommend you read it. Does anybody want to ask any questions before I sum up or add or comment? Please feel free to just unmute yourself and speak up. You don't need to wait for my permission or anything. Okay, so I will... I promised you some silver linings and hopeful foreshadowings, and I don't want to leave you in negativity. So I want to point out that there's a very subtle pattern. You know what? I'll start with a bigger pattern. First of all, the fact that we see a pattern of pseudo-healing or false healing that turns out to be premised on problematic foundations or placed on problematic foundations is very troubling, and it's a very powerful storytelling tool to create false hope and then snatch it away, because it makes us feel this kind of the rise and fall of our emotions in a way that just telling us things were bad and they got worse and worse and worse wouldn't engage us in the same way. But it also shows us that there were good intentions. People wanted to rebuild families. People wanted to avenge what was unjust in their eyes. People wanted to have the tribe of Benjamin survive once their anger cooled off. These good intentions may be expressed in horrific ways, but what they tell us is that these are not unredeemable people. These are people who are in a system that doesn't allow them to translate their positive intentions into a positive way of life. Something needs to change. And this lays the ground, along with a repeated refrain that there was no king, there was no king. Do you get the hint? There was no king. You know what's coming. We need a king. It kind of tells us that if something will change, things might get better. So that's hopeful. But there's another much, much more subtle pattern that has to do with the beginning of the two stories. The story, well, not exactly the beginning. You'll see what I mean. We have Micha in Ephraim, right? And he is... encounters, creates this relationship with a Levite boy from Bethlehem Yehuda. Note the three places, Ephraim, Levite, and Bethlehem Yehuda. Later, we hit the story of the concubine. And again, we have a man who lives in Ephraim, who goes and has a concubine from Bethlehem Yehuda, and there's a Levite man in the story. He's a Levite himself, sorry. He's a Levite living in Ephraim, and he has a relationship with a woman from Bethlehem Yehuda. In both those stories, the encounters didn't end well. The relationship between Micha and the Levite boy did not end well. It ended in betrayal. I would argue that the relationship between the man and his concubine from Bethlehem Yehuda also ended up in betrayal. Yeah. But by the law of three, in storytelling, the third time is the turning point, right? If things repeat themselves, the third time is when things change. We're left wondering, are we going to see another encounter between a Levite, someone from Ephraim, sorry, and someone from Bethlehem Yehuda? And is that encounter going to be, I'm sorry, the turning point of the entire narrative? And the answer is, spoiler alert, yes. Because a book down the line, we are going to encounter a prophet, Shmuel, who is the son of a man from Ephraim, who according to not the book of Shmuel, but Acharit HaYamim, Divrei HaYamim, sorry, was a Levite. So he's a Levite from Ephraim. And when he will encounter a young red-haired man from Bethlehem Yehuda, he will anoint the man, David, the young boy David, who will go on to reform the situation we see here and start us on the path to healing. So this is the hidden promise, the hidden little trick, the little hint to something that's going to change. And next week, we're going to pause. And before we delve into the story of Shmuel and his encounter, first with Shaul and then with David and his whole project of uniting the people, we will delve into one of the sweeter, more pleasant books of the entire Bible, which is Megillat Rut. And we will meet David's antecedents. And we will see how Megillat Rut takes the themes of Shoftim, overturns them, and shows us the route to healing that we will then follow slowly as we track through the two books of Shmuel in the weeks to come. Thank you so much. As always, it's wonderful to see you. And thank you for exploring these stories with me. And I hope to see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. And we'll get out the email bright and early next week. And if you don't get it, let me know. Thank you very much. We look forward. Don't forget tomorrow morning that Marty Lection's on a 4-week summer hiatus visiting his kids in North America. So there's no class tomorrow at 11. We will have, of course, the Sefer Yirmiyahu class with Simi Peters at 1 p.m. Eastern, and at 8 p.m. our Haftorah class with Moshe Sokolow. Shuli Mishkin also is not giving class just for 1 week. This week, that was from the beginning. She couldn't make it Thursday morning, and the Parsha Shir Thursday night will be by Rabbi Moshe Shulman of Young Israel of St. Louis. And then these guys will be giving the Pirkei Avot Shir at 9:30 a.m. And next week, in addition to having back Simi, having back, you know, Shuli, we will be starting on Monday. Alex Israel will be starting his 7-part series on the thought of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, which it should go up today, the registration and stuff. So that's beginning, please God, Monday at 12:15 p.m. Eastern, 7:15 in Israel. Okay, and thank you, Rachel, and we look forward to seeing you next week. And everybody have a wonderful day. Everybody be well, be healthy, enjoy the weather. Now in Israel, no mask anywhere, right? That's what I understand.
No mask anywhere.
We had our lowest count today since September, the lowest amount of cases, but we're still locked down pretty much, and our borders are still pretty shut. It's a little bit crazy. Some of the rules are a little bit inconsistent, but anyways, but Baruch Hashem, we're going in the right direction. Vaccines are wrapping up, but we have a long way to go on the second vaccines. We're about, I don't know, 12% or something. 13% of people. We lead the world in first doses. They made the decision to set them apart 4 months, but we've got a lot of catching up to do. Anyway, you were asking, and I don't know if somebody gave that clear. Yeah. I was trying to figure out.
So no, thank you for telling me. May you all be well.
And we should all be well. Everybody be healthy, and we should have a peace and good things. Internal health, external health, all good things. Okay.
Amen. And
Hatzlacha to the new government in Israel. And a daughter of a former member of Knesset, I guess you know a little bit the political machinations of Israel. It's boy, it's Israeli politics.
I know that the new government, like every government before it, it's not just them. They're probably not aware of the headache they're about to encounter.
it's always easier on the other side, you know. When you get in, that happens all the time here. You know, the government says one thing and they get in, and we didn't realize, you know, we got into power, we didn't realize this, we didn't realize that. But I really hope HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be we need healing, I think, in the country, and I think everywhere. Hopefully the diversity will lead to coming together and whatever. Like I say, you know, whatever they're in, we should pray for their welfare. And should be good. What can I tell you? But and I assume you want nothing to do with politics, a life in politics.
I'll stick with the politics of the judges era.
Yeah. I got it. I'm joking around. I hope you don't mind. But,
No, it's fine.
Thank you very much. Okay,
have a wonderful day,
everybody. Okay, bye-bye.